Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 921. The Trump and Confabanda Part 4, Trump on the Stump. The Underground Reich Emerges into Plain View, Part 2. This is being recorded on September 8th of the year 2016. We are going to wrap up our coverage, not of Donald Trump, but of this particular analysis of Trump as an underground Reich phenomenon, an underground Reich phenomenon that at one level is manifesting traditional German Ostpolitik with his comparatively benign statements about Russia, Ukraine, and Vladimir Putin, something I think is functioning in a manner analogous to the open letter to Stalin published in 1949 in the Steuben Society outlet, the Burger Zeitung. That, along with the responding Soviet note of March of 1952, opened what Konrad Adenauer and his associated political forces and journalistic forces characterized as a bidding war, or an auction contest, in which each side is furiously bidding to outdo the other. I think that on the one hand, Trump's relatively benign statements about Putin and Russia and Ukraine are going to win Trump a certain amount of gravitas in the so-called progressive sector, but more importantly, they are cueing a feverish new Cold War right-wing surge, which is encompassing the New York Times. It is achieving quite a bit of political resonance. On the one hand, and is likely to, or not likely to, is inflaming the political and national security establishments and journalistic establishment in this country, and inflaming them in a right-wing anti-Russian direction. At the same time, Germany is playing both good cop and bad cop at the same time. And I expect ultimately that this bidding war will benefit Germany. I expect the pending transatlantic trade pact to go through. I expect that this will benefit Germany in many ways in the U.S. I would not be at all surprised to see, ultimately, the proposed German trade pact or trade union stretching from Lisbon to Vladivostok that we looked at in For the Records 918 and 919 to come into being. And also, I would expect that Russia will make some concessions in Ukraine, perhaps having an all-EU army take the place of the nuclear-armed NATO, and accepting Ukraine's greater incorporation into the EU trade operations. This in exchange for some benefits to Russia. Again, I think that the Trump statements are very much like the open letter to Stalin from the Burger Zeitung of 1949. At the same time, I think that Donald Trump is quite simply an underground Reich phenomenon, and I think that even though he may not win the election this year, I think that the political and journalistic trends that he is helping to mint here, or accelerate, really, they didn't begin with him, are going to become more and more the norm. Recall that in 1964, Barry Goldwater was viewed as a right-wing nut, and he was handily beaten by Lyndon Baines Johnson. Ultimately, however, the national security establishment, which is in charge of the country, manipulated LBJ into the Vietnam War, which discredited him and discredited the Democratic Party. And ultimately, the right wing of the GOP, embodied by Barry Goldwater, became the norm. Eventually, it moved well to the right of Barry Goldwater, who, at the time of his death, was well to the left of the Republican Party as a whole. I expect something similar to happen. It remains to be seen if the underground Reich controlled and heavily influenced national security establishment, what was codified as the military-industrial complex by Dwight Eisenhower, is able to maneuver Hillary Clinton into a new war of sorts. If, in fact, she wins, that remains to be determined. I am absolutely convinced, however, that what we are seeing with Donald Trump is the emergence of what I have called the Underground Reich, literally a Third Reich that went underground at the end of World War II and perpetuated itself in mafia-like fashion. We are seeing that emerge overground and establishing a broad-based political phenomenon, not only in this country, but elsewhere as well. And for the record, age 82, I took stock of that, what I called the perfect storm. And we're going to be going into that. We will also be reviewing some aspects of Trump's financial backing, which run in the direction of the Bormann Network and the Underground Reich. And we will be taking a look once again at the traditional German Ostpolitik, which was actually being manifested before the end of World War II and advanced to an extent by none other than Alan Dulles. We're going to return after examining Donald Trump's rhetorical style and how similar it is and very possibly influenced by the rhetorical style of Adolf Hitler. We're going to be returning to Trump on the stump and how the media are covering him and how they are covering Hillary Clinton. And we are going to conclude with a rereading of a passage from the book They Thought They Were Free, The Germans, 1933 to 1945, edited by Michael Mayer. I have read this periodically as something of a thermostat, which people can use to measure just how hot the water is in which the frogs that are the American people are very slowly and gradually boiling.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Donald Trump appeared in Mexico City and appeared to be very statesmanlike in his appearance with the president of Mexico and other officials. And then he gave an anti-immigrant speech in Arizona later that day. And in a Talking Points memo editor's blog of September 1st of 2016, Josh Marshall had a column called Blood, Race, and Trump. And we are going to begin with Marshall's observations about the two appearances, the statesmanlike appearance in Mexico City and the rhetorical firestorm that Trump gave his faithful in his immigration speech. In Blood, Race, and Trump, Marshall writes as follows. Let me start with a general comment on tone. Trump's immigration speech was as wild and as unbridled a speech as I've seen from Trump yet. Even if you couldn't understand English, it would be stunning to watch the slashing hand gestures, the red face, the yelling. It's hard to imagine any presidential candidate in living memory giving such a speech. And again, this is if you didn't know what the words even meant. As the speech was unfolding, I said something on Twitter that I'm sure many will find extreme or beyond the pale. But watching this speech compared to the press conference today in Mexico City, what kept coming to my mind was the contrast between Hitler's uniformed rally speeches from the hustings and the suited statesman Hitler that we see in the old newsreels in Munich and at other iconic moments in the late 1930s. The demagogic style, the frenzied invocation of familial blood sacrificed to barbaric outsiders, these are not unique to Hitler. When we see this lurid stab-in-the-back incitement, the wild hyperbole, the febrile railing against outsiders who will make us no longer a country, the similarities between Hitler and Trump are very real. More than anything, perhaps the chilling part of this day is the contrast between the two men, a measured, calm, statesman-like figure that we saw this afternoon, and this railing, angry, demagogic figure who captured the emotional tenor of a Klan rally. As I said, the ability to shift from one persona to the other is a sign of danger in and of itself. I do not think that Marshall was speaking in vain, and I think, in fact, there is substance to his observations. From an article called After the Gold Rush by Marie Brenner, B-R-E-N-N-E-R, from Vanity Fair, September 1st of 1990. Donald Trump appears to take aspects of his German background seriously. John Walter works for the Trump Organization, and when he visits Trump in his office, ex-wife Ivana told a friend, he clicks his heels and says, Heil Hitler, possibly as a family joke. Walter is Trump's cousin. Ivana Trump told her lawyer Michael Kennedy that from time to time, her husband reads a book of Hitler's collected speeches, My New Order, which he keeps in the cabinet by his bed. Hitler's speeches, from his earliest days up through the phony war of 1939, reveal his extraordinary ability as a master propagandist. More about that book that Donald Trump reads, My New Order. This from Stephen Rosenfeld, R-O-S-E-N-F-E-L-D, from Alternet, of December 10th of 2015. Is Donald Trump getting his cues from Hitler? How the GOP leader is following the Führer's recipe? And excerpting this, Adolf Hitler's My New Order, parenthetically the book that Trump reads, according to his ex-wife, is not just any book. It came after Hitler's two-volume Mein Kampf, German for My Struggle, and was published in 1925 and in 1926, before the Nazi rise to national power and World War II. It is not just a collection of excerpts from speeches Hitler made between 1918 and 1941. It is profusely indexed and filled with details about the speech's impact on the media and on the political establishment as well. The American literary magazine Kirkus Review, founded in 1933, puts it this way. Paralleling actual quotations from Hitler's own utterances, the editor of the English language edition includes corresponding data showing the effect on the world press and his own commentary relating the statements to doctrines previously presented in Mein Kampf. Section after section follows this pattern: background, speech, and press reaction. But it appears that one way or another, much of the content in My New Order about how Hitler says propaganda works, and how he structures his speaking style, and how Hitler targets the lowest common denominator as his intended audience, has seeped into Trump. The way he speaks, argues, rages, and responds in public. This goes beyond what has been reported in the New York Times, which analyzed 95,000 words from 5 months of speeches and concluded that Trump shares a style with the 20th century's biggest demagogues. Trump's speeches are filled with simplistic racist attacks, first against Mexicans and more recently Muslims. He belittles and insults his competitors for the 2016 Republican presidential nomination. He attacks Democrats' political correctness as weak. He mocks women and disabled people. He threatens to obliterate the enemies he names. He doesn't care about facts or inconsistencies and plays to his followers' fears and prejudices. All of these tactics, from the repetitive style of his speeches to believing what he says is true, to his excessive and unrivaled view in his own leadership, are modeled by Hitler in My New Order, according to a psychological profile of the book in the September 2013 issue of the Psychiatric Quarterly. The elements of a delusional system are there, it states. This is not simply to say that the man is mad and so has plunged the world into chaos, but it is to say that there is overwhelming evidence in 19 years of his speeches that Hitler himself firmly believes many of his most absurd declarations, including some which are contradictory. What is really stunning, whether or not he carefully read My New Order, is that Trump is channeling the very tenets about how propaganda works that were laid out by Hitler in his books. I've spoken in the previous three shows about the associations that Donald Trump keeps, and basically they are Nazi. Leave it to this country in the year of our Lord 2016 to come up with a politically correct term for Nazi. That's alt-right. I don't like using it. I think probably for communication purposes, I will probably use it more simply because it will resonate more effectively with many people, but that's basically what it is. It is a politically correct term for Nazi or fascist. When you look at the people around Trump, that's what they are. I think there was a very clever on the one hand and altogether sinister on the other dog whistle that Trump once again issued, or the Trump campaign once again issued. This past week, there was a list of 88 former top military officials who are backing Donald Trump. This after a number of national security officials condemned him and supported Hillary Clinton. Mitt Romney, for example, has some 500 former military officials backing him in 2012. While there may have been 88 former military officials, from an actuarial standpoint, that is extraordinarily unlikely. It could have been any number from the standpoint of the mathematical probability. It could have been 65, 170, or whatever. The odds on it being exactly 88 are very slim indeed. 88, of course, is a coded term for Heil Hitler. in the immediate aftermath of World War II during the Allied occupation of Germany. Germans were formally banned from using the Heil Hitler salute, and so they used 88. H is the last letter of, H is the eighth letter of the alphabet. So they said 88 instead of Heil Hitler. I think that is what we are looking at here. A Mother Jones story from September 6th of 2016 by David Korn. Trump announces 88 top former military officials are backing him. It says last month, a group of 50 GOP national security wonks signed a letter declaring that Trump, quote, would be a dangerous president and would put at risk our country's national security and well-being. Now Trump is fighting back. On Monday, he released a list of 88 former generals and admirals who back his presidential bid. And again, I think that the possibility that there was, in fact, exactly 88 is very slim indeed. The New York Times from that same day, September 6th of 2016, had an article, and this is really kind of funny. Donald Trump is endorsed by nearly 90 military figures, this by Maggie Haberman, H-A-B-E-R-M-A-N. Skipping down, describing the group as national security professionals for Trump, Lieutenant General Michael T. Flynn, a retired Army officer who had been under consideration to be Mr. Trump's running mate, said it came together organically. We had to stop accepting names because we were running out of time, he said. That dog doesn't hunt. They have plenty of time. They could have gone up to the election. Again, I think 88 was chosen as a dog whistle to the Nazi faithful, very much like Trump's tweeting of Hillary Clinton with a Star of David saying the most corrupt candidate ever and piles of $100 bills. This originated on a Nazi slash white supremacist messaging board, very much like a 2015 campaign ad that Donald Trump tweeted that featured Waffen-SS clad World War II reenactors. I think this is nothing less than a Nazi dog whistle. In addition to the many Nazi slash alt-right associates of Donald Trump, including Steve Bannon of Breitbart, the de facto manager of his campaign at this point, it is important to take a look at the money behind Donald Trump. And we're going to review some elements that we have looked at in, for the record, 919 and 920, because the money is critical. Once again, about the money backing Donald Trump's operations in, for the record, 903. We took a look at the many mob connections that filter through the maze of Trump real estate projects. It would appear that the bulk of the money, the main financial backing and participation in Trump's altogether opaque real estate operations is Borman Capital Network slash Nazi money. Reviewing now from the New York Times of August 21st of 2016, this by Suzanne Craig, Trump's empire, a maze of debts and opaque ties. Note that the opaque nature of Trump's operations is characteristic of major capital interests that want to avoid scrutiny. The Borman Group is expert at that. And continuing with this, we took a look at this in, for the record, 919. The Times examination underscored just how much of Trump's business remains shrouded in mystery. He has declined to disclose his tax returns or allow an independent valuation of his assets. Earlier in the campaign, Trump submitted a 104-page federal financial disclosure form. It said his businesses owed at least $315 million to a relatively small group of lenders and listed Taz to more than 500 limited liability companies. Though he answered the questions, the form appears to have been designed for candidates with simpler finances than his and did not require disclosure of portions of his business activities. Skipping down. The Times found other instances in which Mr. Trump had an ownership interest in a building but did not disclose the debt associated with it. In all cases, Mr. Trump had passive investments in limited liability companies that had borrowed significant amounts of money. In a typically complex deal, loan documents show that four lenders, German American Capital, a subsidiary of Deutsche Bank, UBS Real Estate Securities, that's the Union Bank of Switzerland, a major foreign bank, Goldman Sachs Mortgage Company, and Bank of China agreed in November of 2012 to lend $950 million to the three companies that own the building. These companies, obscurely named HWA 1293 LLC, HWA 1294 LLC, and HWA 1295 LLC, are owned by three other companies in which Mr. Trump has stakes. Skipping down. In some cases, the identities of his business partners are obscured behind limited liability companies, raising the prospect of a president with unknown business ties. At 40 Wall Street, for example, Mr. Trump does not own even a sliver of the actual land. His long-term ground lease gives him the right to improve and manage the building. The land is owned by two limited liability companies. Mr. Trump pays the two entities a total of $1.6 million a year for the ground lease, according to documents filed with the SEC. The majority owner, 40 Wall Street Holdings Corporation, owns 80% of the land. New Scandic Wall Limited Partnership owns the rest, according to public documents. New Scandic Wall Limited Partnership's chief executive is Joachim Ferdinand von Grumme Douglas, a businessman based in Europe, according to these documents. The people behind 40 Wall Street Holdings are even harder to identify. For 40 years, Germany's Hindenburg family, H-I-M-M-E-B-E-R-G, which made its fortune in the shipping industry, controlled the property through a company called 40 Wall Limited Partnership. In late 2014, their interest in the land was transferred to a new company, 40 Wall Street Holdings. The Times was not able to identify the owner or owners of this company, and the Trump Organization declined to comment. Note the Joachim Ferdinand von Grumme Douglas, apparently part of the German or Austrian aristocracy, certainly an aristocrat of German heritage, and the Hindenburg family, a major container ship firm, one of the largest shipping firms in the world. And again, remember that UBS, the Union Bank of Switzerland, is a major bank that has done business with the Bormann Group. We've talked about that in the past, and there will be links in the description for this program to information about UBS and the Bormann Capital Network. I cannot stress strongly enough that people should use the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning. It is a foundational element of the analysis presented in this program. And on the SpitfireList.com website, Paul Manning was a member of Murrow's Boys. He was trained as a gunner aboard American bomber aircraft so he could cover American air raids over Europe, shot down an ME-109, broadcast the surrender of Germany on the CBS radio network. and was a protege and friend of Edward R. Murrow. He undertook his investigation of Martin Bormann's post-war activities at the instigation of Edward R. Murrow, and his work was underwritten by CBS News, which would not touch the story. More about this reviewing information from For the Record program number 920. Deutsche Bank, which is at the very core of Trump's operations, appears to be the single biggest financial backer of Donald Trump. Deutsche Bank, deeply involved with the Bormann Network, as we will review in a minute.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
From the Wall Street Journal of March 20th of 2016, this by Anupreta Das, A-N-U-P-R-E-E-T-A, Das. When Donald Trump needs a loan, he chooses Deutsche Bank. Skipping down. Despite some clashes, the Republican frontrunner has been a regular client of the German lender. One of Donald Trump's closest allies on Wall Street is a now-struggling German bank. While many big banks have shunned him, Deutsche Bank AG has been a steadfast financial backer of the Republican presidential candidate's business interests. Since 1998, the bank has led or participated in loans of at least $2.5 billion to companies affiliated with Mr. Trump, according to a Wall Street Journal analysis of public records and people familiar with the matter. That does not include at least another $1 billion in loan commitments that Deutsche Bank made to Trump-affiliated entities. The long-standing connection makes the Frankfurt-based Deutsche Bank, which has a large U.S. operation and has been grappling with reputational problems and an almost 50% stock price decline, the financial institution with probably the strongest ties to the controversial New York businessman of any financial institution. Skipping down. Deutsche Bank's relationship with Mr. Trump dates to the 1990s. The bank, eager to expand in the U.S. via commercial real estate lending, set out to woo big New York developers such as Mr. Trump and Harry Macklow, M-A-C-K-L-O-W-E, skipping down. By 2005, Deutsche Bank had emerged as one of Mr. Trump's leading bankers. That year, the German bank and others lent a Trump entity $640 million to build a 92-story Trump International Hotel and Tower in Chicago. More about that building in a minute. Deutsche Bank officials badly wanted the deal because it came with a $12.5 million fee attached, said a person familiar with the matter. The story then goes on to point out that when the housing bubble burst, this frayed the relationship between Trump and Deutsche Bank to a certain extent, but that was only to a certain extent, skipping down. But not everyone within Deutsche Bank wanted to sever the relationship with Donald Trump. The company's private banking arm, which caters to ultra-rich families and individuals, picked up the slack, lending well over $300 million to Trump entities in the following years. And the implications of this noted in a Mother Jones story of June 1st of 2016, this by Russ Choma, C-H-O-M-A, and David Korn. Trump has a conflict of interest problem no other White House candidate ever had. And it reads in part as follows. The presumptive GOP nominee also has a tremendous load of debt that includes five loans of over $50 million each. the financial disclosure form, which presidential candidates must submit, does not compel candidates to reveal the specific amount of any loans that exceed $50 million, and Trump has chosen not to provide details. Two of these mega loans are held by Deutsche Bank, which is based in Germany but has U.S. subsidiaries. And this prompts a question that no other major American presidential candidate has ever had to face. What are the implications of the chief executive of the U.S. government being in hock for $100 million or more to a foreign entity that has tried to evade laws aimed at curtailing risky financial shenanigans, that was recently caught manipulating markets around the world, and that has attempted to influence the U.S. government? It is interesting to me that the media continue to pillory Hillary Clinton as corrupt, etc., and yet they really are giving more or less a free pass to Donald Trump. And by the way, they are not the only ones. Reviewing yet another piece of information that we looked at in For the Record 920. Supplementing Trump's investment in the Trump Tower in Chicago. Again, Deutsche Bank sank a bunch of money into that. And his investments that were financed by Deutsche Bank has been supplemented by none other than a consortium headed up by George Soros. Now, George Soros is the Hungarian-born businessman who has gained a reputation as a financier of the so-called progressive sector in the U.S. I would note in passing that financing both sides of a political argument is the way that veteran players operate. That way, you can be sure of controlling the political process. As we have noted in a past discussion of George Soros, he got his start in business by, quote, Aryanizing, unquote, Jewish property in Hungary during the Holocaust. He was a very young man at the time. However, he has basically described in his autobiography that period of time as being the happiest in his life. And when queried about the morality of doing what he did, he basically shrugged it off. He said that he didn't see anything particularly wrong with it. It was just like the markets, he said. If I didn't do it, somebody else would have done it. Now, that is an interesting and substantively revealing stance for George Soros to make. I have voiced my opinion in the past and will voice it yet again that I suspect that George Soros is a Bormann Jew, to coin the term. In Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, Paul Manning points out that frequently the Bormann Capital Network uses Jewish front personnel, certainly a Nazi money laundering operation could find no better front individual or individuals than Jews to mask the Nazi nature of that operation. It would be easy enough to deflect substantive inquiries. In the Trump Soros Chicago WordPress.com blog, it's the only post on this blog list by Soros Trump Chicago, did George Soros freed Donald Trump of a $312 million debt, this from March 19th of 2016. Skipping down. Soros, along with Fortress and Blackacre, came to Trump with just such a loan at a costly $160 million of principal. The Wall Street Journal had valued the loan at as much as $360 million, depending on the length of time that it accrued interest. Skipping down again. While Trump was not yet making a profit on his tower, his sales and value appreciations were such that his building was generating significant revenue, more than enough revenue to pay back to his lenders large portions of his loans. Of course, why didn't he? Skipping down. At that point, they will refinance the original mortgage and put the balance to work somewhere else where it can make even more money. This is a characterization of Trump's loan. Skipping down again. By all accounts, including his own, Trump was ready and able to pay off the loans for his Chicago Tower, yet Trump did not have to worry about paying back the majority of his mezzanine loan. A special group of lenders came in and erased a significant portion of this obligation. That group was the original mezzanine loan lenders, Soros, Fortress, and Blackacre, all of whom decided to forgive Trump's future interest payments on the loan, selling it to him at the massively reduced price of $48 million. Basically, Soros and the others forgave Trump as much as $312 million for no apparent reason. The aforementioned shows us that in 2012, Trump had already paid off most of the Deutsche Bank loan before Soros, etc. came in and wiped out most of his mezzanine debt. That raises the question, why wasn't Trump expected by Soros, Fortress, and Blackacre to pay back their riskier, high-interest mezzanine loan? In the written description for the Record 921, I have reprised passages that underscore the close relationship between Deutsche Bank and the Bormann Capital Network, including Martin Bormann's own banking with that institution. And also yet another passage discussing Martin Bormann's, the Bormann Capital Network's control of corporate Germany. Recall that John P. Schmitz, the brother of Trump advisor Joseph E. Schmitz, is a lawyer who controls, not controls, but that does a lot of business with major German corporations. He also is married to Columba Bush, the wife, he's married to the sister of Columba Bush, Jeb Bush's wife. That is to say, John P. Schmitz is. And again, there will be key passages from the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, in the written description for the Record 921. By way of reviewing, just not reviewing, but by way of setting forth just how far back the latest incarnation of German Ostpolitik goes, reading now from a book called The Old Boys, The American Elite, and The Origins of the CIA by Burton Hirsch, published in hardcover by Charles Scribner and Sons. Burton Hirsch, H-E-R-S-H. And elements of the SD, that was the SS intelligence service that were headed by Walter Schellenberg, had been floating the notion that Germany would actually ally with the Soviet Union. This was bought by Alan Dulles. And again, my opinion is that what Trump is doing is floating the latest iteration of this particular dynamic of German Ostpolitik, and that that is intended at opening a fevered bidding war to drive America ever more into German arms and to do the same thing to Russia. Reading from The Old Boys. It now became priority number one that as much of Western Europe as possible fall to the capitalist West and as intact as possible. To this end, Walter Schellenberg seems to have concocted an extremely subtle disinformation campaign designed largely to convince one man. On February 4, 1945, Alan Dulles wired the State Department that Colonel Masson of the Swiss SI, who as previously reported, last had close contact with his German opposite number Schellenberg, advised that envoys from Schellenberg were here and hinted he wanted to see me. Envoy apparently tried to create impression that stiff resistance on West Front and maintenance Italian Front as contrasted with rapid withdrawal Eastern Front was part of a plan to open all of Germany to Russia, but that possibly if Anglo-Saxons disposed to modify unconditional surrender contact with Western powers might be useful. Envoy also hinted at some understanding between Germany and Russia to open door to latter. And Alan Dulles basically bought this, skipping down from Robert Murphy to the European Affairs Division Chief, Mr. Matthews, at the State Department. Alan Dulles said that all indications currently received from Germany indicate a definite trend toward the idea that Germany's only salvation lies to the east. The conviction seems to be growing that while the Russians may be hard and brutal, even cruel, and that they will punish the principal National Socialist offenders, they still offer an affirmative economic and industrial future which will protect the Germans against starvation and property. They believe that the Russians will be dependent on German industrial products, which means that German plants will continue to work at full capacity and that the unemployment problem will thus be solved. And there is more in this passage, skipping down. The full passage is in the description for the record 921. By insinuating that Germany might prefer the Bolsheviks, the SD intellectuals were angling unceasingly for negotiating leverage. And I think that is the same gambit that Donald Trump's pronouncements on Russia, Ukraine, Putin, etc. are geared to do. Returning to Trump's rhetorical positions, the Raw Story blog of September 4th of 2016 had a post by David Edwards, E-D-W-A-R-D-S, Soledad O'Brien eviscerates CNN. You have normalized white supremacy with shoddy Trump reporting. Former CNN host Soledad O'Brien blasted the cable news business over the weekend for profiting off the hate speech that has fueled Donald Trump's political rise. According to O'Brien, the media has gone through contortions to make things seem equal all the time, unquote, when comparing Trump to Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton. If you look at Hillary Clinton's speech, where she basically pointed out what Donald Trump has done, and actually done quite well, has been to normalize white supremacy. O'Brien explained to CNN host Brian Stelter on Sunday, I think she made a very good argument, almost like a lawyer. Here is the ways in which he has actually worked to normalize conversations that many people feel hateful. I've seen on-air white supremacists being interviewed because they are Trump delegates, she noted, and they do a five-minute segment, the first minute or so, talking about what they believe as white supremacists, so you have normalized that. And then Donald Trump will say, Hillary Clinton, she's a bigot, and it's covered, and the journalist part comes in. She points out that basically it then becomes a he said, she said, and that the manifestation of this, they are treated as if they are equal. O'Brien insisted that's where journalists are failing, the contortions to try to make it seem fair. The former CNN host argued that the question that journalists should be asking is if Trump is, quote, softening the ground for people who are white supremacists, who are white nationalists, who would self-identify that way to feel comfortable, with their views being brought into national discourse to the point where they can do a five-minute interview happily on national television. And the answer is yes, clearly, she said, and there is lots of evidence of that. O'Brien observed that cable news outlets were effectively being rewarded for bad behavior.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
We're going to conclude with the reading of a passage I have read before. This is from They thought they were free. The Germans, 1933 to 1945, by Milton Mayer, softcover, University of Chicago Press. This is an interview with a German professor who lived through the rise of Hitler. What happened here was the gradual habituation of the people, little by little, to being governed by surprise, to receiving decisions deliberated in secret, to believing that the situation was so complicated that the government had to act on information which the people could not understand because of national security, so dangerous that even if the people could understand it, it could not be released because of national security. And their sense of identification with Hitler, their trust in him, may have incidentally reassured those who would have otherwise worried about it. Their trust in him made it easier to reassure others who might have been worried about it. This separation of government from people, this widening of the gap, took place so gradually and so insensibly, each step disguised, perhaps not even intentionally, as a temporary emergency measure or associated with true patriotic allegiance or with real social purposes. And all the crises and reforms, real crises and reforms too, so occupied the people that they did not see the slow motion underneath of the whole process of the government growing remoter and remoter. The dictatorship and the whole process of its coming into being was above all diverting. It provided an excuse for people not to think who did not want to think anyway. I do not speak of your little man, your baker, and so on. I speak of my colleagues and myself, learned men, mind you. Most of us did not want to think about fundamental things and never had. There was no need to. Nazism gave us some dreadful fundamental things to think about. We were decent people and kept us so busy with continuous changes and crises, unquote, and so fascinated, yes, fascinated by the machinations of the national enemies without and within, that we had no time to think about these things that were growing little by little all around us. Unconsciously, I suppose, we were grateful. Who wants to think? To live in this process is absolutely not to be able to notice it. Please try to believe me, unless one has a much greater degree of political awareness and acuity than most of us had ever had occasion to develop. Each step was so small, so inconsequential, so well explained or on occasion regretted, that unless one were detached from the whole process from the beginning, unless one understood what the whole thing was in principle, what all these little measures that no patriotic German could resent must someday lead to, one no more saw it developing from day to day than a farmer in his field sees the corn growing. One day, it is over his head. How is this to be avoided? Among ordinary men, even highly educated, extraordinary men, frankly, I do not know. I do not see even now. Many times since it all happened, many, many times since it all happened, I have pondered that pair of great maxims, Principis Obsta and Finem Restus. Resist the beginnings and consider the end. But one must foresee the end in order to resist or even see the beginnings. One must foresee the end clearly and certainly, and how is this to be done by ordinary men or even by extraordinary men? Things might have changed here before they went as far as they did. They didn't, but they might have, and everyone counts on that might. Your little men, your Nazi friends, were not against National Socialism in principle. Men like me, who were, are the greater offenders. Not because we knew better, that would be too much to say, because we sensed better. Skipping down. You see, my colleague went on, one doesn't see exactly where or how to move. Believe me, this is true. Each act, each shocking occasion is worse than the last, but only a little worse. You wait for the next and the next. You wait for that one great shocking occasion, thinking that others, when such a shock comes, will join with you in resisting somehow. You don't want to act or even talk alone. You don't want to go out of your way to make trouble, unquote. Why not? Well, you are not in the habit of doing it, and it is not just the fear of standing alone that restrains you. It is also genuine uncertainty. Uncertainty is a very important factor, and instead of decreasing as time goes on, it grows. Skipping down. That's the difficulty. If the last and worst act of the whole regime had come immediately after the first and smallest thousands, yes, millions would have been sufficiently shocked if, let us say, the gassing of the Jews in 43 had come immediately after the German firm stickers on the windows of non-Jewish shops in 33. But of course, this isn't the way it happens. In between come all the hundreds of little steps, some of them imperceptible, each of them preparing you not to be shocked by the next. Step C is not so much worse than step B, and if you did not make a stand at step B, why should you at step C, and so on to D? And one day, too late, your principles, if you were ever sensible of them, all rush in upon you. The burden of self-deception has grown too heavy, and some minor incident, in my case, my little boy, hardly more than a baby, saying, "Jew swine," collapses it all at once, and you see that everything has changed, and changed completely under your nose. Now, you live in a system which rules without responsibility even to God. The system itself could not have intended this in the beginning, but in order to sustain itself, it was compelled to go all the way. You have gone almost all the way yourself now. Life is a continuing process of flow, not a succession of acts and events at all. It has flowed to a new level, carrying you with it without any effort on your part. On this new level, you live and you have been living more comfortably every day with new morals and new principles. You have accepted things that your father, even in Germany, could not have imagined. Suddenly, it all comes down, all at once. You see what you are or what you have done, or, more accurately, what you haven't done. For that was all that was required of most of us, that we do nothing. I have attenuated this. The full passage is in the description for the record 921. Please do use these written descriptions because there is a lot of information I don't have time to fit into the program. This concludes For the Record 921, The Trump and Confabanda, Part 4, Trump on the Stump. The Underground Right Comes into Plain View, Part 2, being recorded on September 8th of 2016. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.